This is Jason Jans here with Sharper Iron Podcast, and I am interviewing Mark Farnham, who is the Assistant Professor of New Testament Theology at Calvary Baptist Theological Seminary. We have done an interview on the history of fundamentalism, one on the current issues in fundamentalism, and then this last interview will be on trends in evangelicalism. And Mark, I think, can speak to this with knowledge. He is a frequent attender, or he's a member of the Evangelical Theological Society, is getting his PhD studies at Westminster, and is very, very widely read. And so we're glad to have him here as a guest. So as we talk about trends in evangelicalism today, how would you sum up the current status of evangelicalism in general?
Evangelicalism is in crisis. It is because of its flawed foundations, it is very susceptible to error. A few years ago at an annual meeting of the Evangelical Theological Society, there was an attempt to discipline out several members who had subscribed to open theism, and in doing that had denied inerrancy. And eventually these two men did not receive enough votes to cast them out. And some of the founders of the organization, going way back to the middle part of the 20th century, stood up and tried to decry where the organization had gone, and said this is not what we intended when we founded this organization. But really, they had laid the foundation for error and left the door open, and as a result, the entire movement is in crisis, whether you talk about the scholarly side of it or even just evangelical churches in general are so cut free from the mooring of biblical theology that many of them are floating and are driven by every wind and wave.
Well, let's plunge into some of the issues. Worship is a hot topic today, but it seems like it's shifted a little bit from a war over music to a war over everything regarding worship, regarding the purpose, who should participate, the whole idea of what your liturgy should be. What do you think is at the heart of the worship wars today?
I think there's great concern because there's been a general belief that error creeps into a church first through the youth group and through music. And
yeah, slippery slope.
Yeah, a lot of people find that to be true. The main issue with worship, of course, is for many fundamentalists, the association with worldly styles of music or with evangelical forms that have become accepted and popular, things like drama within the worship service, which we've always had in fundamentalism, but we've done it differently, and that concerns people, and rightly should. Worship is an issue that should be of great concern.
So how do you see, where do you see battle lines being drawn?
Well, musical styles is probably the biggest one. That's an argument that's been going on for years, and I don't think it's going to be settled anytime soon, just because people are still in transition. People who were so sure of themselves a few years ago are reconsidering, and others are taking a hard stance. But the truth is, within fundamentalism, there is a vast variety of musical styles. We often think that fundamentalist musical styles are identical. But you take, some have Southern gospel flavor. Some have more of a high church sound. Others have more of an acoustic sound. And that's been generally accepted in fundamentalism. And for some reason, we've tried to act like that hasn't been there for a long time.
Hmm. When it comes to evangelicalism, there's debate over this, worship evangelism. What do you think of that whole movement toward, kin the lost worship?
Well, I think that was primarily driven by the church growth movement that was seeking to find any and every means to reach the lost. I think the intent was good, but I think the philosophy was flawed from the beginning. Worship is not designed, I should say worship music, is generally in the scripture not designed to reach the lost. However, in 1 Corinthians chapter 14, there is an example of someone coming into a church and observing the behavior of believers and how they worship, and what is said, and understandable prophecy, and coming under conviction, and saying, surely God is among you. But I do not think that the primary purpose of music is evangelism.
When it comes to, Robert Weber has written a lot coming from, he's actually kind of tried to bring the ancient into the contemporary, and now you're seeing it fleshed out, especially in conservative and liberal emergent type liturgies. What do you think about that kind of revival of orthodoxy?
Well, it would be a mistake to condemn across the board everything that he has done and that group has done. What they've done is react against the pragmatic worship style of the church growth movement. We've had plenty of influence in the church growth movement in fundamentalism. The problem with Weber and the emergent church is they have taken flawed models of ancient worship, focus on icons, various mystical practices, and again, this is a problem because we don't know our theology as well as we should. But not everything that they've come up with is wrong. In fact, some things should provoke thought in us to think about how we do what we do when we gather for corporate worship.
Yeah, it seems like even just in the area of public prayer, there may be a need for a lot of development. Creed, and then now you're actually seeing kind of a return to recitation of creeds, and a hungering for what in the patristic period, that early church experience. Is that a good pursuit?
I think most fundamentalists have unwritten theological creeds, and the concept of a creed is not entirely bad. The purpose of a creed is to give an authoritative interpretation of what we believe. That's good in one sense, that we don't wander into error because it holds us back, but we have to be careful not to make that creed, to place it above the Bible. The Bible is the final authority, and if our creed turns out to be flawed upon further examination, then we modify the creed.
You were a pastor for 7 years, and if you were to go back today and pastor, how would you do worship differently?
Now you're meddling and looking for trouble here. Let's see.
I assume that you would do it differently.
I would do some things differently. We made a lot of changes when I was a pastor. When I first got to our church, we had a very high church kind of atmosphere. I removed some of that just to make it more lively. I would be concerned that our worship would be meaningful. That's one of the biggest values I have when it comes to worship. And to be more creative, visiting different parts of the world. I've had a chance to teach and minister in several Eastern European countries and China, and to realize how bound we are by our American culture to do the same thing. And that's been a great experience, to realize believers do worship, corporate worship, quite differently in different parts of the world. So I'd want to be more creative.
So what would you, what are some other aspects of a liturgy that you would implement?
I like the idea of a church covenant. We had one at the church where I was. Initially, I had our church stop reciting it, mostly because it was very poorly written and did not have a spiritual aspect to it, but it was more pragmatic. You know, stewardship of money and giving to the Lord was considered paying the bills and the utilities, and so it was not a well-written document. So I would probably return to that idea of a covenant and read that together as a church on a regular basis to build more of a sense of community and a goal and a focus of what we are as a church.
I was at a retreat a couple weeks ago, and we had every person who opened a session read a prayer out of the Puritan prayer book called The Valley of Vision. And the first guy that stood up was raised in fundamentalism and said, well, I don't know how I feel about, praying a written prayer. And it's almost like, I remembered Schaeff's work on the Reformation back in the 1600s, when they basically cleared the table, when Luther cleared the table and said, we're taking everything out of Catholicism, we're going to deconstruct, and then we're going to reconstruct, and therefore they did away with icons, did away with all that type of thing. It seems like we still have that lingering element that's too formal, or it's not personal, so it's not real. But I guess my experience with written prayers is they're far more lofty, and they actually bring the sensibilities to a higher level than just spontaneous, God, thank you for this day. Mm-hmm. I mentioned that to you, and you said, if I was in a church, we would pray one of those prayers every service.
Yeah. Yeah. If you haven't heard or read the Valley of Vision, they are excerpts from the prayers of the Puritans, and they are, again, deeply theological, deeply meaningful, deeply transparent, and they far eclipse my own prayers. And as a model to the people, if I was pastoring again, I would want to read those on a regular basis to present a model of what genuine heartfelt prayer is. So that would be one thing I would do in addition.
Let's go move into the area of cooperation. It's still a hot topic even within evangelicalism, especially with the work by Chuck Colson on Evangelicals and Catholics Together, and thus the Alliance of Confessing Evangelicals kind of was born. And it seems like it's still a hot topic regarding evangelicals working together with Catholics. Where do you see this trend going? Or now you're almost seeing an admiration of Roman Catholic theology or theologians and dialogue.
I think this is the fruit of New Evangelicalism's flawed foundation. I know many evangelicals are terribly disappointed that other evangelicals have gone that way. Catholicism in its system and its belief is as much a false belief as any other false religion out there, and we cannot cooperate with false religion. It would be compromising the thing that is most dear to us, which is the truth of the person of Christ and salvation.
Well, where do you see the trend going? Do you see greater cooperation being sought in evangelicalism with Catholics?
Yeah, I think the momentum is going to continue to be not just cooperation with Catholics, but now there's a far greater move toward being welcome and open toward Orthodox. Some well-known evangelicals have converted to Eastern Orthodoxy. It's just a general ecumenicalism that is going to continue, and evangelicalism historically was distinct from that, but now the lines are so blurred that there are many who call themselves evangelical, but they are completely ecumenical, and it's difficult to even identify any genuinely Orthodox Christian statements from them.
Now, some that are listening to this probably are not very aware of this area, but you've had firsthand experience, and that is feminist theology. Seems like it has really taken off in evangelicalism. What does it look like, and what effect is it having?
Well, we have to distinguish between secular feminism and evangelical feminism. Secular feminism is more radical and more bizarre than you could imagine. A few years ago, I attended an American Academy of Religion series of sessions on feminism. I wanted to see firsthand what are they really saying, and every stereotype I had was so tame compared to the reality. Now, evangelical feminists write some very good things against radical secular feminism, but they've also been deeply influenced by it. And the growing feminism, evangelical feminism, and evangelicalism has gotten to the point that for many people in that movement, there are no more role distinctions in the church or in the home. And so there are no restrictions on women in the pastorate. And leadership at home is shared by male and female. And that has opened up a new door in the left wing of evangelicalism to reconsider the issue of homosexuality.
Where would you, what percentage would you say of evangelicalism would be complementarian, and what percentage would be egalitarian?
I can't give a percentage, but I would say in evangelicalism as a general movement, there is a growing increase in the number of egalitarians. I would say far more than 50%. I think complementarians are a minority. I think the culture has deeply affected evangelicals, and as a result, many of them, fewer and fewer of them, have reservations about women in the pastorate, and male and female roles erased in the home.
Hmm. Let's talk. You mentioned Orthodoxy and Eastern Orthodoxy. Christianity Today had an article, I think it was just a couple months ago, that speculated as to whether or not this would become the Orthodox century. Some are very unfamiliar with this trend, but explain the phenomena.
Eastern Orthodoxy has several things, several characteristics that are unique to it, or in some cases attractive to people in it. Its main understanding of theology is what is called apophatic theology. That form of theology says we cannot know anything about God for sure on a positive basis. All we can know is what God is not. And therefore, God remains a mystery. We can know many things about what God is not, but what he really is a mystery that we must pursue and is always elusive. And Eastern Orthodox practices and churches have returned and value highly this sense of mystery. And that is a reaction against the pragmatism of the church growth movement that so made God accessible, you know, come as you are and your cutoffs and we'll rock the house, that many people converting to Eastern Orthodoxy are those who've come out of the church growth movement who are disillusioned with the pragmatism and want to get back to the sense of mystery and awe and wonder. As a result, they've incorporated a lot of different visual and sense-oriented experiences in church so that people have this multi-sensed experience of God.
Yeah, Peter, I think it's Peter Gilchrist wrote the book Becoming Orthodox, where he describes coming out of Campus Crusade with several hundred Crusade staff that became Orthodox over a period of time. And his primary reason that he gives was they saw people accept Christ, but they didn't see any discipleship taking place, and were really wondering where the problem was. And his solution was a more sober faith, thus his move to Orthodoxy. But then you've got Weber with Pilgrims on the Canterbury Trail talking about it as well. Will it be the Orthodox century? Do you think that's going to continue to
And this is why I made the earlier comment that I see conservative evangelicals becoming more like fundamentalists who want to continue to be biblical. The continents of evangelicalism and fundamentalism are separating, and there's a vast ocean growing between the various factions, such that unless you become in the near future, I think, a conservative evangelical with the spirit of fundamentalism, as R.C. Sproul said, you are going to be in the midst of a group of people who are wandering spiritually. And Eastern Orthodoxy right now is the attractive option because people are looking for spiritual experiences. It presents a number of awe-inspiring and mysterious practices that people find satisfy their searching souls. And conservative evangelicals are critiquing that as much as we are, if not more.
So what's the danger of becoming Orthodox?
The danger of becoming Orthodox is a denial of the positive statements in Scripture about who God is and what he's like. It is also a return to idolatry in the sense that there's a huge focus on images, a huge focus on mysticism as opposed to a propositionally based theology. Eastern Orthodoxy is all about sense experience and mystery to the neglect of propositional statements. They will not take a stand on statements such as the Bible is the inerrant word of God. They want to say the Bible is the path to God. It is the life-giving way in which God, through his Spirit, enlivens our hearts and creates new worlds for us. But they do not want to make propositional statements like we're used to.
So where would they stand, whereas evangelicals would say it's the Bible alone for authority? Would they be similar to the Roman Catholic Church in adding tradition? And
yes, they have a heavy emphasis on tradition. They do not, each branch of the Eastern Orthodox Church, whether they be Greek, Ukrainian, Russian, and so forth, they each have their own head, so there's no one universal pope that oversees them all. So their authority is definitely tradition and experience. And as each new experience comes down the line, becomes popular, they adapt that and make it their own. And so it's a very experience-oriented kind of religion.
Okay. Let's jump over into postmodernism. What effect is postmodernism having on theology in the church?
Postmodernism as a philosophy, is considered by many people in Europe as dead. It's been shown to be self-defeating and self-contradictory, but it has still a huge impact on the way Americans think, because it has made our experience in reality and in life a personal one, in which I cannot tell you what reality is in regard to God or the state of mankind. As a result, then, postmodernism has deeply influenced the emergent church, where, again, there's less and less of an emphasis on propositional statements and more of an emphasis on personal experience and experience of God in a mystical way.
What about the, you mentioned it a little bit earlier, the openness of God debate, the idea that God does not know the future and that God can change, actually. Can you briefly explain the issue and where it stands today, even stuff that you personally witnessed regarding ETS and Pinnock and company?
Sure. Open theism is a viewpoint that says that God knows the past and present perfectly, but cannot know the future free acts of mankind because they are nothing to be known. Open theists began to write heavily in the early to mid-90s, and the issue came to a head in the Evangelical Theological Society around 2004, as the more conservatives in the group decided we need to disallow people that hold to open theism to stay in the society. It has influenced quite a few people, primarily because of its view on evil and suffering. Greg Boyd, one of the open theist most popular writers, talks about his inability to explain evil and suffering by saying God willed it, and so he would rather explain it in such a way that that God could not have foreseen the future free acts of wicked people, and so he's as much dismayed and troubled, and he suffers with us, and we can just rest in the fact that, that God will bring about his eternal plan, but God is disappointed in where things have gone also.
So what, you were there at the vote. What
yes.
was it like?
Well, there's about 2,500 Bible scholars and theologians in a room, and there were two men on trial for statements they'd made in their in various books on open theism that, that in essence denied inerrancy. And those were that was John Sanders and Clark Pinnock. And after the charges were brought against them, there were two open mics, one available to those who would like to speak up for them to say they should stay in the society, and another mic for those that say that that were willing to say this is heresy and they need to be disciplined out and we cannot allow open theism. What interested me was people that I thought would go to one microphone went to the other.
Who was at each microphone?
I can't remember all the names, but I think of some theologians and Bible scholars from even some mainstream seminaries, Trinity and others, that spoke in favor of allowing them to continue in the society. Other theologians that I thought would be more radical from, you know, from more liberal Christian colleges that stood up and said, this is a heresy, this must go, we cannot allow this and tolerate this. Probably the most impressive person was Norman Geisler, who stood up and sounded like a fundamentalist of old, and he, with great passion and persuasiveness, argued that this was dangerous, that we could not allow this, this was an abandonment of the society. He was one of the early members and said this is not what this was all about when we started it. And he was roundly applauded but also roundly criticized. And in the end, majority of the people there voted to dismiss John Sanders, and a significant number voted to dismiss Clark Pinnock, but neither one, neither vote was enough to actually discipline them out of the society. And since that time, it has... it has died down somewhat. It's not as nearly as big an issue, but it's had a great impact in popular writing. Greg Boyd, a number of years ago, wrote a book called Letters to a Skeptic, where he dialogues with his father, who's a skeptic. And in that book, when his father questions him about evil and suffering, he says, well, it wasn't God's fault. God couldn't do anything about it. Mm-hmm. And that's had an influence in the way people understand that issue.
Well, you talk in your lectures a little bit about the post-conservative evangelical. Describe for our listeners, what do you mean by post-conservative evangelical?
Post-conservative evangelicals are those who still claim to be evangelicals, still claim that salvation is through Christ, and yet they are on the far left of the spectrum of evangelicalism, to the point that the line has grown fuzzy between these people and liberals. They still claim some of the key things that an evangelical would, but in so many areas they are extremely liberal in everything from views on politics to the environment, to social action, to theology. These post-conservatives are involved in bringing about open theism, and yet they still claim that salvation is through Christ, and they call themselves post-conservative because they do not want to be identified with those who still maintain conservatism within evangelicalism.
Who are they?
They would be people such as Stanley Grenz, who was a theologian who just passed away this year. He's written a number of books. John Franke writes as a postmodern theologian and an ardent and open postmodern theologian. Roger Olson, who is a church historian, is also would be considered post-conservative. And certain seminaries and schools such as Fuller Theological Seminary, quite a bit of Bethel Theological Seminary in Minnesota would be post-conservative. Regent College, North Park Theological Seminary in Chicago. Many of these schools have gone decidedly, and Biblical Theological Seminary in Hatfield, Pennsylvania, just a few miles from here, has made a definitive and a deliberate choice to become known as a postmodern seminary.
I close with Wells when he says, "The only semblance of cohesion that now remains is simply tactical, never theological. Evangelicals are not driven by a theological vision, and those who have risen to positions of leadership must commonly reflect this diminished outlook." And he talks about the family of hybrids, that there's now evangelical Catholics, evangelicals who are Catholic, evangelical liberationists, evangelicals who are liberationists, evangelical feminists, evangelical ecumenists, ecumenists who are evangelical, young evangelicals, orthodox evangelicals, radical evangelicals, liberal evangelicals, and talks about how the word has totally lost its meaning. And he says, "I believe it's the dark prelude to death when parasites have finally succeeded in bringing down their host. And amid the clamor of all these new models of evangelical faith, there's the sound of a death rattle." Mm-hmm. And Moeller, I think, says it's become the circle without a circumference, that it really, truly is in crisis. And so what is the solution for evangelicalism?
That's the question of the hour. If you knew the answer to that, you could write a best-selling book. But I think what is happening is those evangelicals who are conservative and are articulate are leading the day. People like Al Mohler and some within the Southern Baptist Convention, people like Mark Dever, Nine Marks Ministry, people, a number of people down at Westminster Theological Seminary who are rallying to conservative theology and are writing in opposition to this to these developments within evangelicalism. I think of people like John MacArthur, who most people would put him in the evangelical camp, but is even more fundamental in some ways than some of these other guys. There's no clear consensus in leadership, but I think last year the Together for the Gospel conference was a huge indication of where things are going. Here's a conference on the gospel, about as plain and as boring as you could have a conference on, at least initial appearance, and yet so many people are hungry to reaffirm the gospel and to hear presentations on it that it was sold out months in advance. You could not get a flight into Louisville on the days before the conference, and they touched a nerve there. And so it will remain to be seen what will happen in evangelicalism, but I think there are many in evangelicalism that are hungering for a leader or a coalescing of conservatives that will, in their mind, as Sproul says, have a double spirit of the historic fundamentalists.
Great. Well, thanks for your time, and you've been very helpful, and I trust that your words will encourage pastors who are out there in America trying to serve the Lord and make sense of the issues surrounding them in their communities.
Thanks, Jason. Appreciate it.